So now that we know everything there is to know about DNA and genetic genealogy, that was a crash course, wasn't it? And thank you for explaining that. I was telling Steve here between episodes, I have a very, very limited knowledge of DNA. I'm fortunate that I know how to spell DNA, and that may be as far as it goes. So your explanation made it a whole lot easier for me to understand rather than doing research and trying to figure it out myself. But we want to get into the case now of the what's known as the Golden State serial murderer.
Yeah, Golden State Killer.
So GSK. And this is something that my partner and I talked about a few years ago when we first started Game of Crimes here, was to find somebody. And there's so many fantastic stories out there and guests that you can bring on the show here. And it just worked out through Seth, through the introduction, through Seth Webb to you to bring you on here. And I love the fact that that's what we're going to cover now. So you're a division counsel working in the Los Angeles Field Division. How did you find out about GSK? Did that pique your interest? What was it that you thought, man, that's something I want to take a look at?
Yeah, it was 2013, actually. I think it was February of 2013, and I can tell you how I remember that. I was working in the Orange County office of the FBI, near my house, which living in Southern California, anytime you can live close to your house is great. And I no longer had a 2-hour commute to the LA office. And I had finished working as a special assistant United States attorney a couple of years earlier after about 10 years doing that. And so I was just working at the FBI office, working cases and helping agents, with their cases, approving things like that. And I was looking for something interesting to do that I could help with. And one Sunday afternoon, I was at home. And I remember I was reading the LA Times, and the LA Times had an insert magazine called LA Magazine. Mm-hmm. And there was an article there about this killer in California. And the article was written by a woman by the name of Michelle McNamara. And it was a great, great article that she did. Really, really great piece of investigative reporting and talking about who this Golden State Killer was. And let me just tell you a little bit about this guy and why it made it so interesting. So first of all, nobody knew that we had a serial killer in California for over 25 years. I mean, we had no clue. What happened, the Golden State Killer was actually known by three separate names, and they were not connected. There was a guy called the Vasilia Ransacker, and this is a guy in 1974 to the end of 1975 was burglaring houses in Visalia, California. Visalia is a town in Central California, kind of halfway between L.A. and Sacramento. Visalia Ransacker would break into houses, and a ransacker, he just ransacked the house, open up the drawers, dump stuff out, things like that. They're kind of sexual of nature because he'd take women's underwear and take your bra, panties, put them on the sofa, lay them out in the bed, just kind of weird, sexually perverted stuff like that. Mm-hmm. He would tear out photos from the family album, only take the woman. He never really stole a lot of value, but he'd take one earring. There'd be two nice earrings, he'd take one. Just weird stuff like that. There's some evidence he may have masturbated at scenes because we don't have lotion like this at our house. And why was that lotion there? Who knows? He ended up one night breaking into a home, getting on top of a 16-year-old girl, put a knife to her throat, and wearing a mask, dragged her outside into the driveway, trying to, essentially kidnap her. Her father woke up. His name was Claude Snelling. He heard the commotion, opened up the front door, saw this masked man pulling his daughter away. The masked man turned and shot him twice, killed Claude Snelling right there in his doorway. Then he kicked a girl a couple of times, and then he ran off into the dark. Eventually, a very smart detective, was able to set up a stakeout and chase the Vasilia Ransacker down. But the Vasilia Ransacker ended up shooting the cop, hitting his flashlight, the cop's flashlight, kind of blinding the cop for a few minutes. He was okay with minor injuries, and then took off into the dark. That was the end of the Vasilia Ransacker. Okay. Interesting. 6 months later, we have a individual in Sacramento, East Sacramento, that became known as the East Area Rapist. Now, this individual, his MO, which he kind of progressed to, first he started attacking women home alone, but his primary MO became attacking couples. So you're laying in bed in the middle of the night, sleeping with your wife or your boyfriend or whoever, and like, he always liked attacking couples. And he'd wake them up in the middle of the night, shine a flashlight at the foot of the bed, wake you up, and you're like, what's going on? And he'd shine the flashlight on his gun. You'd see he has a gun. And then he'd pull out of his pocket pre-tied shoelaces. Sometimes the shoelaces were actually from your closet. So he'd be in your house before you even knew it. And then he'd throw the shoelaces to the woman, order her to tie up the man. So he'd have to roll over, put his hands behind his back, he'd tie him up and tie his legs. And then he'd tie up the woman and then retie the man. And then he'd go get to the kitchen and they'd be laying there wondering what's going on. They hear him rummage around your kitchen. He'd come back and put plates, like dinner plates, glasses on top of the man and just tell the man as he's laying there, if I hear these plates fall, I'm going to kill you. I'm going to kill your wife. I'm going to kill your kids in the other room. And then, and so he'd just stack these plates up like an alarm. Now, interesting enough, the Vasily ransacker actually did similar stuff too. Like he'd put plates and cups like this, like he'd put it on top of the doorknobs and things like that in the house. So if somebody came into the house while he was rummaging around, he'd hear the plate fall. So the similarity there in some of the technique. He'd take the woman in, the East Air rapist, would take the woman to another room, untie her feet, and then proceed to rape her. He'd stop after a few minutes, tie her back up. He'd go in the kitchen, make himself something to eat, have a beer, sometimes sit on a lawn chair, then he'd go back and rape her again. Sometimes three, sometimes four, sometimes five times. And he'd check very regularly on the man to make sure he was still there. And then after raping, eating their leftover, put her back in the room, in the bed. And then they never knew when he would leave because he'd leave very quietly. Sometimes they'd be think he's there or think he's gone. And then one of them would feel a knife against her throat. So he was very good about like, so you'd be too scared to like get up and leave. Like, so you never know when he left. You'd lay there for hours sometimes. And so he was long gone by the time they were able to get free and call the police. So he was able to do this almost 50 times in East Sacramento. And then he expanded outside Sacramento to the Bay Area. Incredible technique, like just incredible, like that he got away and the police were looking for him everywhere. That ended in 1979. Yeah, but before that, in 1978, he ended up murdering two people. Brian and Katie Maggiore were walking around 9:30 at night, 21, 22 years old. He was an MP at the Air Force Base. The neighbor saw or heard some screaming, saw flashes of light, looked out their window, and they saw Brian and Katie running. The flashes of light were a gun flash. Brian was executed, and then she kept running, just like out of the movie Halloween, right? Like, this masked man chasing this woman through a backyard, just like that. Like, I think Halloween came out that same year. Katie ran, tried to get away, tried to squeeze between a fence to get into another yard. It couldn't get through, and this masked man came up, grabbed her head, and put a bullet in the top of her head, ran off, didn't stop. Eventually, this crime spree, the East Air Rapist, ended in 1979 in July, and then 3 months later, it picked up in Southern California. Same MO, couples, same type of thing primarily, but now, instead of leaving the couples, he was bludgeoning the couples to death, but usually with an item from the house, like a log, a hammer, or something like that he could find at the house. So that went on for several years until 1986. So he killed 10 people there in Southern California. So you had three separate individuals, the Vasily ransacker, the East Air rapist, and then you had these individual crimes, 10 murders in Southern California, that Southern California didn't even put together until 1998, when the Orange County Crime Lab ran the DNA from all 10 of those murders, and they realized, oh my God, we have a serial killer that was operating here 20 years ago. And they're like, holy crap. And so he was dubbed the original Night Stalker at that point in time. And they called him the original Night Stalker because there was previously a Night Stalker that actually happened after in the mid-late 80s, Richard Ramirez. And so he was the person they called the Night Stalker. So this guy was dubbed the original Night Stalker since this crime occurred before. So now we have three separate guys. So this article that Michelle McNamara detailed all these crimes, it was incredible. A few years after the identification of the original Night Stalker as a serial killer, in 2001, I believe it was, the DNA technology in Sacramento caught up to where it was in Orange County, and they were able to compare the original Night Stalker to the East Air rapist, and that's when they realized that we have this serial killer. But this didn't get a lot of press. Nothing really happened. No one knew much about it. Michelle McNamara writes this article in 2013, and she's the one that says, let's call this guy, because right in law enforcement, we just called him the ear, used ear rapist, or ear ons, original Night Stalker, ONS. So ear ons, not a very publicity worthy name or sexy name. So she calls him the Golden State Killer. Like, this is what he's pretty known as. So I read this article about all these crimes I just told you about. I'm like, fascinating. I tell my wife, I know stuff about the DNA. I work for the FBI. I can call the FBI lab. We can solve this. I know I can do this. Like, I can get everybody together, and I'm sure the FBI lab can figure out a way. I was thinking maybe take the DNA and CODIS, and you can do what's called a familial DNA search that'll find like a relative of somebody that might be in CODIS. Maybe we can do that. And she's like, okay. So this is kind of the cool part of, being at the FBI, the federal government. You know, we work with the local police all the time, like DEA. So I go in the office the next day. There's one of my buddies is a task force officer, which is a deputized local officer, sheriff deputy, who works there. I'm like, hey, who's working the East Air Rapist original Night Stalker case? He tells me, I'm like, it's a buddy I know at the Orange County Sheriff's Department. So I call him up. I'm like, hey, man, can I help out in this? I might be able to do something with the DNA. He's like, yeah, Steve, absolutely. I'll send you the stuff. Gave me access to it. And so that was in 2013. And I just started getting invited to like all the case meetings that we'd have in Orange County, and coming up with different ideas how we might solve it. And we're trying everything. And to go back and look at all the crimes. Was he in construction? He was really good. He was really good about breaking into houses. He seemed to have knowledge of like how he was really, like how to open up windows without shattering them, things like that. How to dismantle locks. One of the weird things, he'd like unplug like the heaters in the house and the AC unit. Why? I don't know. We're assuming because he wanted everything to be quiet so he could hear anything in the house. I don't know, but very, very sophisticated in that. So that is kind of how I got introduced to the case. And then at one of the meetings after a few years, we had DNA in the case. Obviously, there was a lot of DNA from all the separate rapes and crimes that he committed. They had, not me, but previous investigators at the crime lab had taken the DNA from one of the rapes, and they'd got something called Y-DNA. It's a Y-S-T-R, remember, short tandem repeat. The Y-DNA is DNA that is passed only to men because women don't have a Y-chromosome. But if you look at the Y-DNA, the STR on the Y-chromosome, you can match that to other people, other men with Y-chromosomes. And if you have similar or the same Y-STR, then you might have some relation. Now, it's not to tell you and I apart. I mean, we could have the same YSTR. It would just mean that we might have a distant relative. But why it's important is that generally Western European culture for the last 600 years is most men, they keep the surname, the men in their family. So your surname, Kramer in my case, would follow, like my dad, his last name is Kramer, and his dad's last name is Kramer, and we all have the same Y-DNA. So we have the same YSTR. So if you can match a YSTR profile to somebody else, there's a chance that you might get a surname match. In fact, one of the first cases solved with Y-DNA was done that way. Colleen Fitzpatrick, who's a genealogist that did it on a murder case in Arizona, she looked at the Y profile and said, it's really common with the name Miller. And the cop said, well, we have a Miller on our suspect list. Well, might want to check him out a little more. So they went back to Miller, got his DNA, and his CODIS STR matched perfectly. So that's why Y could be useful. But unfortunately, we just did not have, a lot of luck with YSTR in the Golden State Killer case. But while we're talking about, at these meetings, everyone wants to try a different angle on it. I'm only interested in the DNA. One of the guys I meet at the meeting is a detective investigator from Contra Costa County, California. His name is Paul Holes. Paul Holes and I like totally click. We're like, DNA is the only way we're solving this case. Like, I am not going to go back and look at police reports and try redo the work that investigators did in the 1980s and the 1970s. And there's been a ton of amazing detective work on this case. Like, the guys that had worked on it had done, like, I knew Kevin Poole he was a detective from Orange County Sheriff's Department. The work they did on it was amazing, like incredible. Like, I saw all the summary reports. I'm not going to reinvent their work. That's something to do no good. They're all probably much better investigators than me. I'm not, but I was going to try something different, the DNA. And so Paul Holes and I were like, how can we get this DNA to work? So we thought, well, maybe if we search a bigger database with the Y-DNA. So one of the advantages of being at the FBI, you know, versus being maybe in Costa County or some other local department, is those three letters. Mm-hmm. For some reason, those three letters, they get a lot of attention when you call a company and you say, yeah, we have an attorney with the FBI on the phone that would like to speak to you right now. Usually your call gets put through. So I was able to talk to a lot of these big companies like Ancestry and 23andMe, because that was, at the time of the first Ancestry, we wanted to get access to their Y database. So we did. We talked to them about it, and they had gotten rid of it. They didn't have it anymore. So then we're like, well, what if we could get to the profiles? Like, I don't know what these profiles are called, but like when, like, I know people, like, they do that test. You know, you order Ancestry 23andMe kit, right?
Yeah.
Like, you spit, swab your cheek.
Yeah.
And like, you guys can find all your relatives, right? Is that an STR? Like, that'd be great. Like, no. No, they're like, that is not an STR. It's a different type of profile. Oh, so I can't give you my STR? Like, we have it. We have a lot of STR from the Golden State Killer. I can't give it to Ancestry. Can I give it to 23andMe? No. That doesn't work. That profile is from a different part of the genome. It will not work. It'd be like trying to give like a license plate number to Verizon and saying, hey, tell me who this license plate belongs to. And Verizon's like, we don't do license plates. So we had to figure out how do we get the right profile. And this new profile for genealogy is called STR. It's called a single nucleotide polymorphism. So you have one nucleotide, like an A or T. So everybody might have an A, but somebody has a T, that's the polymorphism. It changes. You can't look at just 20. You have to look at several hundred thousands of these SNPs. But the cool thing about SNPs, whereas STRs are really good about saying that DNA belongs to you and you only, the SNPs can be used to show these are all how everybody's related to you. So STR, I don't want anybody related to you. I want you. SNP's the opposite. There's going to show how much you're related to everybody. And that's the way DNA works, because if you have a set of SNPs, half of them go to your kids, and then 25% of them approximately go to your grandkids. And so the more DNA, the more SNPs you share with somebody in common, the closer you're related to them. So that's the idea behind it. Let's get a SNP, and maybe we can get some relatives of the Golden State Killer, because this guy was so good. Nobody knew what he looked like. Always wore a mask, always wore gloves, didn't have his fingerprints, anything.
I've seen some of the sketch drawings of him online, and doesn't look like the same person to me in any of them.
No, not at all. And that was part of the problem in the case, was all the sketches. There were a number of sketches that went out, and you can imagine like phone calls we would get. I believe in 2016, the FBI offered a $50,000 reward, put the sketches out. So we're just getting calls all the time. That sketch, you know, looks like a guy I used to date. And he was, you know, he used to tie me up, and, you know, he was, had a bad temper or whatever it was. And like, so we have to go check him out.
Yeah.
So you can imagine we did that for thousands. We had 8,000 people on our suspect list. We swabbed hundreds and hundreds of people for DNA. Sometimes it actually got to the point, this in Orange County, and there's plenty of investigators in Northern California. We'd call and be like, all right, let's just go check this guy, Steve Murphy, out. And we'd go knock on your door. FBI, somebody said you're a serial killer. Do you want to give us your DNA and prove that you're not? Or like, what do you think? We just want to rule you out. Everyone's like, how quick can I give it to you? Like, we just eliminate them that way. Because unless obviously they looked really, really, really suspicious, you know, for something in their background, then you do a much more detailed, you know, surveillance, things like that. But we had no clue who he was. So I started talking to the different genealogy companies like Ancestry, 23andMe, Family Tree DNA, and the CEO of Family Tree DNA. None of them would help. No one wanted to cooperate. And I didn't want to force legal process down because I just didn't think legal process would be necessary. And I spoke to the CEO of Family Tree DNA. And I said, look, man, I'm trying to solve this terrible serial killer case. He murdered at least 13 people and raped, you know, 50 women or more. He's committed you know, hundreds of these burglaries. Like, we got to figure out who this guy is. He's like, you know what? Because I served on a federal grand jury. I totally believe in what you guys are doing. Absolutely. Because you know what the right thing to do is? The right thing to do is for me to help you guys out. If you need my help, I'm here. I'm like, perfect.
Excellent. Excellent. And which company was that?
Family Tree DNA.
Family Tree.
And the name of the CEO is Bennett Greenspan, who's since become a very good friend of mine. And he's like, yeah, let's do the right thing on this. And so I'm like, what do you need? He's like, give me the DNA, Steve. I will get you a SNP. I'm like, perfect. And I will get you a SNP, and I'll put it into a database. So we went to Ventura, California Crime Lab. We had a little briefing with the DA's office and the crime lab. Paul Holtz and I explaining what we do, how to get it. And crime lab agreed to give it to us. They're like, okay, we'll do this. And so I ended up getting the DNA. I had an FBI agent in Ventura, California. I went and picked it up from the crime lab, and he FedExed it out to Bennett Greenspan's lab, Family Tree DNA in Houston, Texas. And they got a SNP, and they uploaded it. And it takes a few weeks. And it was pretty funny. You don't appreciate this. Well, you can imagine that some of this is, you know, getting out in the FBI of what I'm doing and stuff like that. And most people didn't really understand it.
Right.
But, oh, yeah, like our attorney. Like, he's not even an investigator. He's not a special agent. Just in my office working. And I'm working with a couple of agents we're all working on together. And I'd picked up the phone. It wasn't like I was going rogue. I actually had called the case agent in Sacramento years earlier, a year or two earlier. I'm like, hey, man, can we work on this case and help you out? And he was like, yeah, go. I'll take all the help I can get. So,
right,
I mean,
right.
It was all legit. But it was funny. Like, here I am, attorney, working all this DNA stuff on it. And I remember I was getting emails like from FBI headquarters from the lab, like, hey, you can't be doing that. Like, you're breaking policy. Yeah, you can't be sending FBI evidence out. I'm not sending any FBI. I'm not violating any policy. This isn't FBI evidence. This is evidence that belongs to Orange County Sheriff's Department. We're facilitating it. We're mailing it to another lab. And truly, I wasn't touching FBI evidence. It's an FBI lab. But it was just funny. I laughed. Instead of getting help, there was always a little bit of pushback. As you can imagine, federal government, that's what we're all about a lot of times. I had to fight a few of those fights. I was really fortunate. My supervisor, who was the chief division counsel, was super supportive. His name is Paul Raimondi. He was great. He was like, go ahead. You're not doing anything illegal. You're trying to solve a crime. Why would we not be doing this?
Right.
So, yeah.
Smart.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, we talked to headquarters and other people at DOJ. Everything we were doing was completely legal. There was nothing wrong with it. So we waited. Paul Holtz. And I waited and waited and waited. And like for a few weeks, the matches came in on the Golden State Killer. And we're like, holy crap. We looked at the matches on Family Tree DNA. And like the first time in 43 years, think about this, we actually had forensic related evidence. That is the relatives of the Golden State Killer. Now, we knew none of these people on this list were the Golden State Killer.
Right.
But we knew every one of them was related to the Golden State Killer. Maybe just in dozens or whatever, but for the first time, we actually have evidence that we know is directly related, not just somebody that picked up the phone and called us or some wild theory that somebody came up with that we want to follow down. We got real forensic leads now in this case.
And now everybody wants to be your friend.
I mean, then all my friends are kind of laughing at this. They're like, can we help? Can we help?
Oh, yeah.
It was pretty funny. So we ended up putting it together. Paul Holtz and I put together a team of six people. Plus, we had a genealogist because I didn't know anything about genealogy. Neither did Paul Holtz. Like, I mean, you tell me, Steve, like, what's a third cousin once removed? I don't even know what a third cousin. What's this once removed? I knew nothing about it. None of us did. So Barbara Reventer was a genealogist that actually had worked with Paul on a previous case. So he knew a little bit about it, but he also knew Barbara, who came in, kind of gave us guidance on how all of this worked and how to use these websites. So our team, which was an investigator from Sacramento County, the attorney's office, Kirk Campbell, and Monica Sadowski was an analyst there. And then in my office, I had an analyst from our violent crime squad, Melissa Pariseau, and myself. And then I had two other special agents, Chris Kicking and Steve Rathall, that were also on the violent crime squad. my wife, by the way, was a special agent on that. She was on the bank robbery squad. So she got to see all of this, you know, plus she had to deal with me at night that I was constantly working on this. But so we had a really good crew of people. I also had another special agent, David Shea. We had a whole team of people at this point, like run down leads, do the genealogy. But the six of us that I mentioned first did the genealogy. It took us about 5 weeks of doing genealogy. It was 36 days. We had a pretty good free. We had like 23 suspects identified at that point because we knew this is what we did. We know that he's a white guy. We know he's somewhere between 5'8 and 5'11. It's on the victims that survived. We know his blue or greenish eyes, blonde hair, maybe a little balding. Knew that he had some connection, obviously, to Sacramento, maybe to Southern California. So we knew a few basic things about him. So we went through our list, and genetically, we looked for people that had to be in that genetic line. And we were looking at, you know, the third cousinist, second cousinist level. Mm-hmm. We knew we were looking for men. We figured he's born between 1940 and 1960 in a pretty big range. But we ended up a list with 23 men that kind of fit the profile. Like some of them didn't have California connections. Some of them might have been like 6'1". They kind of were a little lower on the priority, you know, and other people maybe got ranked higher, but we looked at everybody the same. And so you can imagine, okay, we build this, right? You've never done genetic genealogy. I've never done it. And we have a list and we have a suspect list. We've never done this before. So we're like, I wonder if this is right. And any of these guys really be our guy? Why don't we get somebody like on our tree? Like say there's make up a number, like say there's 150 people on our tree and we have 23 suspects of those 150. And we only have like 3 or 4 DNA related matches that created that family tree. Mm-hmm. I like to go verify that this is actually right, right? Like your math, so to speak. And did I do this long division problem correctly? Let's get the calculator out and let's actually see if I did it right. So why don't we go test somebody? And so I found a woman that was on the tree, and I wanted a woman because I didn't want somebody that could potentially be, you know, suspect a man. And I wanted it to be convenient. And she happened to live 2 miles from my house. In fact, I drive right past her house on my way home from work. So why don't we get her DNA? And so Chris Kicking and Steve Rathall, the two special agents that were working with us, we're on it. And I remember really well. It was about 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They take off. They go find her. They chat her up. Super cooperative. 3:45, they text me a photo of themselves with the DNA, you know, in the DNA container. Mm-hmm. And they're all smiling. I'm like, something. She was super cooperative. They took that DNA. They didn't bring it to the office. They just threw it. They went to FedEx and FedExed it to Family Tree DNA. So we waited a couple of weeks and we got her results back. And her results were great. We were correct. We were on the right track. And that took that list of 23 down to 6. And now We only have 6 guys.
Oh.
Yeah, we were stoked. And then of those 6 guys, two or three of them had connections to California. One of them was like 6'2", so we knew he wasn't 6'2".
Right.
But the one guy we looked at was Joe D'Angelo. And Joe D'Angelo looked really interesting because he lived in Sacramento, East Sacramento. I remember the UCR rapist. He lived in right where all the crimes occurred. And he had address history in Southern California. So we started looking at him really carefully. And we figured out he was a cop. He had gotten fired for shoplifting. Now, Paul Holes could not believe it was Joe D'Angelo. Could not believe it was Joe. Like, there's no way a cop would have this much time to commit these crimes. Because these crimes were detailedly planned, and he lived 15 minutes, Joe D'Angelo lived 15 minutes side of East Sacramento and Auburn. So they're like, he just could not have done it. But we looked into him a little more. One of the things that was interesting I found, he got arrested for shoplifting at the end of July in 1979. The last East Area rapist attack was July 5th, like 2.5 weeks earlier, July 5th. So why is it that when Joe D'Angelo gets arrested for shoplifting, there's never another East Area rapist attack? In fact, he got fired from the police department a few months later. That's a weird coincidence to me.
Right.
Why would he automatically stop? It was just a weird coincidence. One of the other weird coincidences was during one of the rapes of the East Area rapist, the woman had reported back that the masked rapist, the Easter rapist, had been yelling at her, "I hate you, Bonnie. I hate you, Bonnie. Are you sure it wasn't mommy or anything like that?" And they said, "No, no, no. It was Bonnie. He definitely hates a Bonnie." So we're researching Joe D'Angelo. Find out, I think it was 1972, he was engaged. Joe D'Angelo was engaged to a Bonnie, a woman named Bonnie. And then they ended up breaking that engagement off. That's another weird coincidence. But, well, he was a cop. Where did he go to the police academy? That was our next question. So then we went back to the state of California and got his police records. And he did his police academy at a place called College of the Sequoias. And College of the Sequoias is right dead center of town in Visalia. And guess when he went to the police academy? Right in the middle of the Visalia ransacker attacks. So he was going out at night, committing these burglaries, including the murder, while he was a police cadet there at the academy. So
unbelievable.
And we could go on. There's other. We did pull his gun registrations. He had gun registrations, like, all timing wise, it lined up, you know, with a lot of the crime. So we did all that. We're like, he's our guy. This is our guy. And so I remember, like, Skicky, Steve Rathall, David Say, all of us, like, piled into my office. And we're calling the case agent in Sacramento. We're all very excited. This is our guy. I have the DMV photo, his address. So we call up Marcus Knutson, who's the special agent in Sacramento. I'm like, "Marcus, we got the guy. You got Golden State Killer? Yeah, you check this guy out." And usually he didn't take me very seriously. But when I give him names that we're looking at, this time he took us seriously. So we're all in speakerphone. This is our guy. His name is Joseph D'Angelo, and he lives up there in Sacramento. Here's his address. They're on it. And they said, "We'll take it. We'll go get his DNA." So they surveilled Joe D'Angelo around for a few days, and eventually they got a swab of a door handle off a car where he's parked in a parking lot. I remember very well. It was that was a Thursday. They took it to the crime lab. See, the Sacramento crime lab is super excited about it too.
Mm-hmm.
Been 43 years been looking for this guy.
Yeah.
And so they rushed it and did a 24-hour turnaround. This is to get the STR. I always tell people, genetic genealogy will never put the wrong person in jail because you always confirm it, like, with an STR, like a direct comparison. So I remember at 6 o'clock, I was at my daughter's swim team practice and my phone rang. It was Kirk Campbell from the Sacramento DA's office. And Kirk said, "Steve, what I'm about to tell you, you can't tell anybody." I'm like, "We got him." All he could say, because as soon as he said that, I'm like, "We got him." He goes, "We got him." I'm like, "Holy shit." So I hung up the phone. And I think a minute later, I forgot if Paul called me or I called Paul. And Paul Holes and I, like, we're like, "Can you believe it?" I'm like, "I can't freaking believe it." And the worst part was, I was going out with some of my friends that night after pizza with my daughter and her friends. And I was so excited. I'm like, I got the coolest news. I can't tell any of you guys about this. It's like, really, I'm like, it's like earth shattering news. It's incredible news. It was, so it was really fun. So over the weekend, we had to go get back and get another DNA pull. We took a trash on Monday, and like most people in my office didn't know. I finally called the special agent in charge, the SAC, I think on Monday or Tuesday or Monday, I think it was. I'm like, "Hey, you remember that case? We solved it." "Really?" I'm like, "Really?" Yeah, it was pretty cool. And then I had to ask, me and the team, we want to go up to Sacramento for the arrest and all that. And they said, "Yeah, go up there." So we flew up in Sacramento Sheriff's Department, did the arrest of Joe D'Angelo, basically kidnapped him from, he was in the front yard, and they wheeled up in a van and grabbed him. And that's how they arrested him, because they were afraid, because he had shot at cops before. So they weren't with anything. So, and then brought him back to the police station. And that's how it started. So that's how genetic genealogy started. I always joke, like, I remember, I think it was Chris Gicking, came into my office like a month later. He goes, "Man, I thought we would, be all excited about, like, solving the Golden State Killer case, this big, you know, serial killer." But he goes, "The real victory is, like, well, you guys have created this new technique, because our phone is ringing off the hook. How'd you get that case? What'd you do? Anything." And that's obviously became the real news on that case, is that we solved it through genetic genealogy. And that's why today almost cannot see any case that was solved through genetic genealogy where the press doesn't reference the Golden State Killer case. So I always say it's the watershed case on that. That's the one that really broke it open. So that became the big thing. So that's kind of the whole story of how we got to do, forensic genetic genealogy.
I was telling Steve here before we started that there's a new television series out. We've all heard of CSI Miami on CBS. And this year, in 2024, they came out with a new docu-series. It's called The Real CSI Miami. And I was actually in a couple episodes, episodes 7 and 9. And one of the things they asked me to talk about, they brought me in because of my experience in Miami back in the late 80s, early 90s. And I mean, quite honestly, because of the Narcos connection on Netflix. They want me to talk a little bit about DNA, and I've never worked a case with DNA in it. So I had to do a lot of research. And you haven't even seen my notes. I pulled out my old notes here. And after I did, I was trying to figure out the difference between mitochondrial DNA and nuclear DNA and DNA profiling or fingerprinting and all the different CODIS and INDIS and all the different things. I looked at what's the most prominent case, the most famous case, the Golden State Killer. And there's the bullets on the Golden State Killer case. That's the one that popped up. So, and here's the cool thing about this, that in my opinion, not only did you create a new evidentiary technique that was coming along, but you showed how it could be beneficial. But you're looking at a case that the guy, his last crime was committed in 1986, right? Last known crime.
That's correct. Last known crime.
And you guys didn't look at it until 27 years later.
Right.
Holy cow. It's just, and that was one of the things that, as I was doing research on DNA, is how DNA technology has progressed over the years. I did want to ask you quickly about the, so you basically got touch DNA when you went and swabbed the door handle in the car and then you pulled things out of the trash. So explain to our listeners, are there any legality concerns about pulling, we're talking about now the, what's the killer up in Long Island, the Lysa, Long Island serial.
Gilgo Beach Killer.
Gilgo, yeah. So they got pizza, I think pizza crust, and got his DNA from that. So what legalities are associated with that?
Well, let's talk about the door handle swab that we did in the Golden State Killer. There are two reasons that we went back and got it trashed. One, the profile from the door handle, I believe, was partial, or it may not have been good enough to put into CODIS. I mean, it was good enough to identify and say, yeah, we got the right guy. But the legality is touching the car handle, the door handle, arguably is considered a trespass. And there was a Supreme Court case authored by Justice Scalia called the Jones case, where law enforcement put a GPS tracker on a car. Mm-hmm. And like, we've done this for years. And I don't know if you remember this at the DA, but like, we put a tracker on the car. And we call them slap-ons, right? Just slap it on the back of the car, underneath the car. And it was great because then you could just go back to the office, pull up your computer, and that's where the stash house is, right? It was really easy versus driving around through a bad neighborhood, risk getting shot,
right,
type of thing, right? Or spooking the bad guy. It's a great technique. And the Jones case, the Supreme Court basically said keeping that tracker on the car for weeks at a time is an invasion of the person's reasonable expectation of privacy, but it started with the actual touching of the car. So touching the car, slapping the tracker on, creates a trespass. From that trespass, an illegal trespass, you can't take anything from that. It's been tainted, essentially. So the idea is that swabbing the door handle, you're touching the car, that would be a trespass, but the DNA would not be admissible for the identification of Jody.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the thought. But not a big deal. We'll just go get the trash. Now, you can pick up the trash because that's abandoned DNA. And the Supreme Court has said abandoned biological evidence has no expectation of privacy. There are a few states out there where cops cannot take your trash, even though you put it out in the street. You need a warrant to do so. But federally, under the U.S. Constitution, unless there's a more restrictive state law, you can go pull the trash once you put it out in the curb. Like, they can't go to your backyard and take it out of your trash can.
Right, right.
But once it's off the curtilage of your property and you've abandoned it essentially to the trash company, then you can take the items in it. Also, like Gilgo Beach, throw away a pizza crust, something like that. It goes into the trash can at a public place. That's clearly abandoned. And so there's no expectation of privacy in it. So those are kind of the legalities of getting abandoned DNA. The cigarettes, that's the big thing. Usually you try to get something that touched your mouth because saliva has really good DNA. So forks, straws, bottles, things like that. So a lot of times police will follow somebody around, watch them throw away a cigarette or watch them dispose of eating utensil. So all good DNA and it's abandoned. So it's legal for us to take and look at.
When you guys arrested D'Angelo, what was his reaction? Was he cooperative or combative?
So he, I believe he was 72 years old, and the detectives would tell you that he did not move around like a 72-year-old. Very fit. Unlike the stuff you saw in court, very fit. You know, he rode an enduro motorcycle quite fast. He, you know, had a bath boat. He was, had a mountain bike. He's just about 200 pounds. Very solidly built guy. Mentioned earlier, there was concern about him shooting a police officer. We were kind of afraid, too, that he might, like, pulled over, and if he was suspicious of previous surveillance, that he might, you know, shoot a cop or something like that. So
right.
We had a detective, one of the deputies from Sacramento County Sheriff, undercover, went up, asked him for directions, was talking to him, gave the signal. The van pulled up, pulled him into the van. I think one of the first questions he said was, "Hey, I have a roast in my oven."
You want to come in for dinner?
Exactly. Trust me, the roast in your oven burning right now is the least of your problems. So he came in and he was, we put him into an interview room and he was not cooperative. He didn't ask for a lawyer. He just didn't say anything. Several detectives, you know, tried to talk to him for several hours. He never gave any answers. The only time he did speak is like when we'd leave the room and he was being recorded, he'd mumble stuff, but nothing that coherent, nothing like, "Oh, I did it." But he did talk a little bit about like he'd been a bad person or something to that effect, but he didn't give any direct confession or anything like that. I didn't engage at all with the detectives. Remember, this guy's smart. I mean, he worked in several different police departments, had a criminal justice undergrad, I believe a graduate degree, been in the military, you know, been in Vietnam. This is a guy that he knew all the tactics. He knows everything.
Right.
Like, we'd bring him bottles of water, knew he liked like Dr. Pepper. You see the photos, we have all these different things in front of him that he could drink from. He didn't touch one of them. Because he knows, like, they're going to try to get my DNA. I mean, we already had his DNA. It didn't matter. But,
yeah
he wasn't touching anything. So, yeah, he's not a dumb guy at all.
So when you guys were obviously somewhere along, did he get court-appointed attorney or did he retain counsel?
I believe, I don't know the exact answer. I mean, I know who his attorney was, but I don't know if he was retained or court-appointed. I'm assuming that he was probably court-appointed. Being a death penalty case.
After they saw the evidence, what was his response then?
Well, the case went on in pre-trial stages, for over a year, I think. And the big issue, like, in that case, you can imagine, I think there was, like, 75 surviving victims, including the men, were victimized, by
him.
Yeah. But you can imagine, like, a lot of them were aging. Mm-hmm. Kind of started in the mid-1970s. So, someone died already. And so you have an issue with your witnesses trying to remember and coherent to remember to the details or even wanted to deal with the details after so many years. So there was, and then penalty case can take 10 years in California. Now, likely, Angela could die in prison. But more importantly, like if some of these victims truly want to see justice, do they want to wait their age in 10 years for this and go through, the tribulations of trial and all of that? And so I think the decision was made, like, if you'll take a plea to a life sentence, full life sentences, we can, close this case and get justice for everybody. Everyone can have their day in court. They can go to the sentencing and literally, and they did this. A lot of the victims did this. They got to go to court. They got to go to court and look them in the eye. I will tell you, it was funny. One of the unique things about the Golden State Killer, one of the physical attributes that was described by multiple victims in this case was his endowment size. And it wasn't particularly large. And so literally he was like, one of the physical descriptors is like, you have a small penis. But did the person that sexually assaulted you have a small penis? And so that was one of the things that was, noted in all the police reports. And so I'll never forget. I won't name the victim, but it was great because at the sentencing, it went through the factual basis being, a short description of the facts of the crime and how this woman was violently sexually assaulted by Joe D'Angelo. And he put in from the original police report and she described him as having like, a very small penis. And I'll never forget. It was awesome. You can imagine like in front of in a big auditorium because it was during COVID. And she was standing there right in front of him. Like standing there and when they said that, you could see it was just like this in his face. It was great to see, like, not only You getting convicted, you get the embarrassment public to have this announced, and
Oh, yeah.
it was just good. I felt very happy to
There's
victim that
there.
she could see him just have all the humiliation possible.
Yep.
So that
You
was part
know.
of the, you know, the pleading of guilt, you know, to, you know, life imprisonment. So I mean, I think it was a very good result. I think I can't speak for the victims, but I think a lot of them probably are happy to have this all behind them. I know some of them said we originally arrested them, like, I don't have to worry. I don't check my windows now every night that they're locked. For the last, 30 years, 40 years, I've always checked my doors and windows multiple times at night, thinking that he might come back. And now I don't
Wow.
have to do that. I just thought, like, oh my God, what a relief that is.
Well, I was looking at some of the statistics, and it looks like that he was involved. I don't know how many he was convicted of, but it's at least 13 murders, at least 51 rapes, at least 120 burglaries. Holy cow. I mean, this guy, this guy's his own crime wave. Do you remember how many murders he was actually convicted or he pled guilty to?
He pled to all 13 of them.
Did he?
That's the 13 that we know of. I mean, I think if you talk to most of us, do we think he committed other crimes? Yeah, I absolutely do. I'm sure he did other sexual assaults that maybe were never reported. Maybe he did other murders that, he was sophisticated. Maybe after 1986, the last time we have a crime that he did, what happened in 1986? We had the first DNA prosecution,
Wow.
in England in 1987,
Oh, yeah, that's
or in
right.
1987. The first U.S. prosecution crime was done through DNA. So maybe at that point, he's like, I won't leave my DNA. I won't leave my semen there. Doesn't mean he won't commit a sexual assault. So you just don't know. Like, this guy is not a dumb guy. I mean, I didn't get into it, but if you can imagine, like, you talk to anybody that lived in Sacramento in the 1970s, early 1980s, everyone can tell you about the East Bay Rapist. He had
Wow.
that town like on lockdown. People were buying dogs, deadbolts. Citizens were doing citizen patrols. The police were actually had night vision goggles, if you can
Yeah.
imagine that.
Yeah.
They were sitting on stakeouts in the canals because he used a lot of the canals behind the homes to traverse. And how this guy committed, like, don't know, like, how he was able to sneak in to East Sacramento into these areas and commit these crimes so blatantly and then sneak out. That's why Paul Holes is like, there's no way a cop would do that. Like, somebody would know he's missing. So it was
Yeah.
incredible.
So there was another investigators going to sit down with him to debrief him on tactics and methods and for learning purposes. Or he may have just refused to do that.
Yeah, I mean, we've made a few requests to talk to him. He doesn't want to talk, at least not yet. I imagine, I mean, here's the crazy part about Joe DeAngelo. This is a man who had three daughters. And these are like, they're all, all with, in the medical field. They're all like, professionals, have done well for themselves. When we did the search warrant, the house where we arrested him, we did it the next day. He lived with his granddaughter and, walked into her room. He built a beautiful, like, playhouse for her, beautiful in his backyard. And, he had her animals and stuff there. Like, clearly taking, great care of his granddaughter. And I think he had decent relationship with his daughters based upon that. And, I met his daughter who were, after we arrested him, who were devastated.
I'll bet.
What they told me was like, he was just a normal dad. He was just a dad. Seriously, like, you can imagine that, like, 72-year-old father. All of a sudden you find out, like, someone says, yeah, he was like one of the most prolific serial killers, in U.S. history that was not caught. Like, that's pretty incredible. Like, he raped 50 women. And some of these were happening while while his daughters were alive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You can imagine how, it'd probably be difficult to imagine how they felt. But yeah, they were very, I think, traumatized by it. So I think part of it too, and I'm just speculating, but he probably wants, he doesn't want any more notoriety coming to himself that would negatively impact his daughters, I'm sure.
Right.
Yeah. So I wish, I mean, I exactly what you just said. I think a lot of us, not just the general public has curiosity, but law enforcement, like, how did you do it? Like, what's the mindset? How were you able to do these crimes? How did you evade the police? What was missing? What were we missing? Clearly, law enforcement was missing something that you were able to get away with it. how did you do that? Like, and those are just questions that remain, you know, unknown that would, I think, be really helpful to law enforcement. One thing I will tell you, though, and you probably know this, like, you know, there's always the thought that serial killers never stop. Like, yeah, they're killing machines. They're just going to keep killing, keep doing their crimes. And, you know, that's not true in all cases. And the other thing about that I've learned from forensic genetic genealogy, and I think Paul and I talked about this too, because we've all seen in our careers lots of homicide cases and things like that. And I've done lots of serial killer cases now with genealogy. But what we found, a lot of people like commit a crime or two, particularly when they're young and maybe in their 20s, they stop and go off and live a normal life.
Yeah.
Which is really, like, so many cases we've done, like, yeah, this guy did a sexual assault homicide and murdered a girl. And then a couple years later, he has a nice job and has a family and they live, like, we've arrested plenty of people that live in nice neighborhoods and have family and kids, just like, you know, Joe D'Angelo. And, like, yeah, they committed a horrible crime 30 years earlier. Like, that's one of the things that we've kind of learned. But, it's really interesting in mindset of these people and how they can do that. I don't know if they just, they realize they did a bad thing and they try to turn their life around. I don't know what it is. But in Joe D'Angelo's case, we'll never know if he truly changed that we don't know about.
Yeah. What year did you retire from the FBI?
2021, end of 21.
And can you say what you're doing now, or do you prefer not to?
No, absolutely. I'm happy to chat about it. So, you know, after the Golden State Killer, you know, I told you our phone was ringing like crazy about how you did this. One of my friends at the FBI, Steve Bush, who is a special agent, he used to run the SWAT team for Los Angeles. He had gotten hurt in a work-related accident a few years earlier, so he was not really in a position anymore to go out and do tactical work and be, you know, wrestling guys out in the field. Like I said, we'd worked a lot together in the past. And in my legal work, I did a lot of stuff with the SWAT team. And so he came to my office and he's like, Steve, man, like, this is amazing. Like, teach me how to do this because we got to do more of this. And so I got, a lot of phone messages from people that want us to call back.
I'll bet.
So, yeah, so he and I started what eventually became the FBI genetic genealogy team, which today has over 200 people nationwide that do it. And Seth, who you mentioned in the beginning, is one of the people that's on the FBI genealogy team. And so Steve and I started this team. So Steve ended up becoming like the first full-time FBI agent that just did full-time as part of a violent crime squad, forensic genetic genealogy. We went back to FBI headquarters, got approval from the deputy director to create the national team, which we started. But we just realized after a couple of years, you can imagine it, it's hard to get money, hard to create a new program. You know, it was just very difficult. And we realized that we need to automate this, make it better. So we both retired from the FBI in 21 to start a company that would automate this genetic genealogy. Because what are the one thing all cop investigators want? They just want the easy button. They want to make it easy. Like,
right.
I don't want to know what a second cousin once removed is. I don't care what a SNP or an STR is. I don't care. I just want to know who the bad guy is.
Yeah.
So our goal is to create the easy button and automate genetic genealogy. And so, yeah, we left and created this company called Indago Solutions. And so we're just automating genealogy. So we're long process, but it's working. We've had a couple of successes recently. We work with both law enforcement and the defense. We recently solved a case with the Innocence Project. We have another case that we're working on with them, a couple more. And so I like that. Like, we can, you know, bring justice to both sides, wrongfully, you know, accused as well as those unknown. So yeah, it's a good process. It's a great process, I should say. But for Steve and I, we still work with law enforcement all the time. Seth, who you talked about, we're working with him right now on a case and it's great. Except, you know, Seth's really good at it and he may beat us to the punch on it. So.
Cool.
Yeah, no, it's good. That's what I like the best. Is like, I love still working with law enforcement. I work with law enforcement every day, working cases all over the world and try to bring, you know, justice, you know, to all these cases, whether it's a cold case or whether it's an active case.
And our regular listeners have probably, you know, every once in a while we take shots at defense attorneys. And you know, when we retire from law enforcement, we kind of look at, if you go to work for the defense, that you're going over to the dark side is what we refer to. And that's, you know, what you got to do. But in this case, it's different because you're exonerating innocent people. And when I was doing my research on the DNA, and this has been roughly a year ago now, as of April 2023, 575 wrongly convicted people had been exonerated since 1989. And the last thing we ever want to do in our country is put an innocent person in jail. So that's why I'm not taking the shot about going to the dark side, because it's the right thing to do. And I can't imagine the phone calls you're getting. I bet every cold case investigator in the world is calling you guys.
Oh yeah, no, all the time. It's great. And to do that, and whether, like I said, whether to exonerate somebody, I mean, there's cases, in some cases, like maybe people didn't understand DNA as well back in the 90s and stuff like that. And maybe the prosecutors and the detectives didn't put as much weight on it. I have no idea. But, or maybe they're overzealous to, you know, convict somebody on a confession or a witness ID. I have no idea. But there's just cases out there where people get convicted and the DNA doesn't match them.
Right.
So what I can tell you is who that DNA belongs to. And it's up to the rest of the investigators and the prosecutor to make a determination of whether that person committed the crime.
Right.
But I can tell you who the DNA belongs to.
What a fantastic investigative tool you guys have. I mean, you just really jumped this light years ahead. The fact that it's just amazing that 27 years after the crime and you're watching this lady who, McNamara, I think was her name, but I think she's passed away since, right?
Right, right.
And you took a personal interest. That, you know, that's one thing I try to stress to, especially young people that call me, and hey, I saw Narcos, or, you know, your career's inspired me to go in law enforcement, that kind of thing. I try to tell them, this is not a 9-to-5, 40-hour-a-week job. This is a lifestyle. And the fact that you're sitting at home on a Sunday watching a TV show and like, wow, how can I apply this to our case? And you solved a case that's, I mean, you, the arrest was made. You started looking at it in 2013, I think, wasn't it?
Yep.
And he was arrested in 2018. Is that right?
Yep.
So it's just, I mean, man, you guys are, you and your team are a testament to what law enforcement is all about. It's, you just don't, you never take time off. You know?
No, I appreciate it. Yeah, it's funny. Since 2013, that case, like the paperwork and everything on it and the newspaper, it sat on my desk every day.
I'll bet.
For 5 years. I did not take it off my desk until 2018, and because it was always there, and like, if I had a few moments. But I, going back to what you just said about, you know, the 7 day a week and all that, I think part of it too, and it applies not just to law enforcement, you have to have curiosity. And that was part of it. It's like, just because somebody has done something the same way for years and years and years doesn't mean there's not another way to do it. There's having that curiosity, like, why is a CODIS FTR the only way? Can we use it for something different? Can we try something else? And having a curiosity, any job, but really in law enforcement, where, and I say particularly because stuff in law enforcement is so ingrained and so traditional. And like, Steve, this is the way we do it at the DEA. Steve, this is the way we do it at the FBI. Like, I want to do it that way. Answer this. It's like, well, why don't we do it this way? I don't know, but we always do it this way.
Exactly. Exactly.
I'll give you an example. Like in the FBI, when I started the FBI, we did not do any recordings. An FBI agent would never, ever record an interview because the word of an FBI agent, you know, is gold.
It's sacrosanct.
Yeah,
yep.
Yeah. We did not record. Obviously, it's completely different today. But yeah, so I think having that curiosity to learn something new, and that's what I wanted to do. Like I said, I was interested in seeing, like, there's something we can do that's different with DNA. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, inspired me reading her article to do that. And obviously it worked out. It turned out great. But yeah, I think the more like we think about that in law enforcement and you wrap your brain around things like trying to do stuff different ways, it's good for the profession. It's good for justice.
Yep.
Our ultimate goal is to put the, you know, bad people in jail.
Absolutely. Protect and serve. That's what law enforcement's all about. Yep. You're a public servant and that's a badge of honor that you wear proudly. So thank you so much, Steve, for giving us your time today. I just talked to Steve maybe a week ago to set this up. I've been doing a lot of travel and it just, our schedules worked out perfectly. I got home last night. I think you're getting ready to head out here soon again, and I'm heading out next week again. So what you did, the incentive that you took to take a look at this old case just speaks volumes as to what can be done when we dedicate our lives to helping our fellow man. And you're a perfect example of that. So what I say to you for all our listeners and our viewers is job well done, young man, to you and Steve Bush. Thank you for your service to our country, for what you've done and what you're continuing to do. Because we all took an oath when we took these jobs. And I've got a little corny saying, just because we retire doesn't mean that our oaths expire. you and Steve are a living example of that. I know you've got a ton of other stories. We were talking offline a little bit, so I certainly see you coming back in a future episode if you don't mind.
Yeah, anytime. We can talk a lot. So I'm more than happy to talk. But I love talking about cases and law enforcement and solving cases. So,
well,
so more than happy.
We remember that you're a lawyer, and we know lawyers love to talk. So that's all
that's
good.
For sure. That's for sure.
Steve, if you'll hang on just for a minute, and for all our listeners, stand by for the debrief.
Well, that's it for this week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. I can't thank you guys enough for taking the time to see and hear some of the best true crime content you can find anywhere. I know none of this would be possible without your support, and I don't take that very lightly. You keep me motivated to find the best guests out there so we can all hear their tales of bravery and daring do. You know, and I'm extremely proud of the guests that come on the show. Their willingness to be so transparent and honest about their lives and experiences. You know, before each episode, I ask the guest if there's anything they don't want to talk about. 99% of the time, they tell me nothing is off the table with them. I can ask anything. In fact, the only time they ask me not to mention something, like where they live or maybe please don't show their faces, is because they are still receiving death threats because of some of the courageous and unbelievable acts they were involved with. These are real-life heroes, ladies and gentlemen. People just like me and you with families who risk their very lives to protect and defend all of us every single day. You've probably heard the saying, real heroes don't wear capes, right? That's who I'm talking about. These studs and studettes, they don't wear capes and they don't parade around like fictional superheroes that we see on the movies or on TV. Our heroes wear uniforms, body armor, bulletproof helmets, knife-resistant gloves, gun belts. They carry handguns, long guns, stun guns, anything that they can find to help protect themselves and us. Just think about that for a second. Does your job, does your career require any of this? Thank God we have men and women willing to make these sacrifices and do these jobs. And thank God for their families as well. I refer to them as our unsung heroes. They keep life running on the home front, not really knowing if their husband, wife, child, brother, sister, whoever, if they'll make it home at the end of their shift or the end of their tour. You think that might cause a little tension around the house, a little stress, anxiety, post-traumatic stress syndrome, maybe even thoughts of suicide? It takes a special person to tolerate and endure that. They do it 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. Now, a quick side note here. Regardless of who you are, if you or someone you know is struggling with any of these conditions, conditions like overwhelming stress, anxiety, hopelessness, PTSD, please don't think you're alone. If you need someone to talk to and you don't know where to turn, there's the National Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. All you have to do is dial or text 988. That's it, 988. Their lines are manned around the clock every day of the year. They'll find someone, a professional, for you to talk to and get the support you need. Again, it's just dial 988. One other thing about our guests that I find so admirable is the fact that they didn't stop serving once they retired. Almost all, if not all of them, continue to serve others in some capacity after retirement, don't they? I have a saying that applies here. Just because we retire, that doesn't mean our oath's expired. Is that a little corny? Yeah, sure is. But that's the way most of these heroes feel. It's their creed, their mantra, to keep doing good things for other people. So to all our guests here on Game of Crimes, it's an honor and a pleasure to have you on the show. Thank you for your service to our communities, to our countries, and for taking the time to tell us about your adventures. To you, I say, job well done, brothers and sisters. May God bless and protect all the men and women in law enforcement, our military, and all our first responders. Now, if you like this week's episode, head on over to Apple or Spotify and hit those 5 stars for me. It only takes you a minute, and it really helps support the show. If you didn't know this already, Game of Crimes is now on YouTube. Just type in Game of Crimes Podcast in the search bar at the top and see what you think. And while you're there, do me a favor, click on that subscribe button, the like button if you'd like, and feel free to share that with all your friends. You can send me your comments on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or to my email address, which is gameofcrimespodcast@gmail.com. My website is gameofcrimespodcast.com. This is where you'll find all our episodes, books written by some of our guests, some merchandise, and more. On Facebook and Instagram, you can find me at Game of Crimes Podcast, and on X, type in Game of Crimes. Also on Facebook, now you got to check this out. Go to Game of Crimes Fans and join the best private group on the Facebook platform. This group is run by our favorite mafia queen, Sandy Salvato. She's the lady that rules with an iron fist, but she does wear a velvet glove. And if you're looking for even more content, go to patreon.com/gameofcrimes and sign up. There you'll find bonus episodes each month ranging from serious and current topics to some silly and fun events. And you can get early access audio to each week's interviews before they drop on YouTube or wherever you listen to podcasts. And I'm talking those are free of commercials, commentary, and music. You just hear the podcast. You can even subscribe for free on patreon.com/gameofcrimes and hear the first 5 minutes of each episode to help you decide if you'd like to spend some of your hard-earned cash to hear more. Again, that's patreon.com/gameofcrimes. Do me a huge favor. Tell your friends about Game of Crimes. Invite them to check out the show. I appreciate you helping me spread the word about the best weekly true crime podcast out there. Am I a little biased? Yeah, probably. As I mentioned earlier, your support, and I mean this is what keeps me going. One last thought. It's okay for us to have different ideas and different opinions, but it doesn't mean we can't continue to be friends, okay? Finally, thanks for joining me to play the biggest, baddest, most dangerous game of all, the Game of Crimes. I'll see y'all next week.